It is Wednesday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Jakarta, Indonesia has a new governor. Turkish officials review petitions to annul the recent referendum that creates an executive presidency.
I think the referendum is still going to be classed as legal. The question, of course, is rather whether it's going to be regarded as legitimate.
And a new Disney documentary explores wildlife in China. It's all ahead. Residents in Jakarta, Indonesia, voted for the city's governor in a runoff election Wednesday. Incumbent governor Basuki Tajah Purnama congratulated his successful opponent, former education minister Anies Baswedan. It's the second such vote for the office after neither candidate captured more than 50% of the ballots cast in the regular February election. VOA Steve Miller spoke with reporter Kritika Virugar in Jakarta shortly after the polls closed.
Kritika, the polls are now closed. What are the various quick counts predicting as the outcome of today's election?
It seems like a definitive victory for the challenger to the incumbent governor, Anies Baswedan. He's coming in anywhere around 55 to 60% of the final vote. The quick count votes say that he's winning by a comfortable margin.
Overall, what was the mood during the election? Because there had been some tension with some more conservative elements saying that they wanted to have individuals observe the actual voting today.
That was a lot of bluster, but it was true that the Jakarta police took no chances and deployed 60,000 military and police personnel around the city to make sure no disturbances happened. So, you know, whether or not they had called for that, there would have been quite a lot of security, which you could see everywhere today.
You mentioned back in February that a lot of people heading to the polls had a very exuberant disposition. Was that mirrored again today?
People are still happy to vote. This is a polarizing election, and in polarizing elections, people feel strongly for their candidates. So it's true that everyone I saw seemed, you know, excited to vote. They had a holiday day off. Indonesians, you know, love voting. But there was definitely a tension today since the stakes seemed much higher in a way that it was in February when people kind of assumed it would go on to a runoff. This time, the people I met in neighborhoods like Pasar Ikan and Luar Batang, who were evicted by Ahok, were extremely emotional until it was called.
Now, Basuki Tajah Purnama, also known as Ahok, is currently on trial for blasphemy, and the proceedings were temporarily suspended because of the election. Do we have an idea what's next for Purnama now that the election is said and done?
Honestly, no one knows. The bigger question would have been what would happen if he were convicted and had won today. That would have been, terra incognita. At this point, the stakes are considerably lower. Many observers think he'll get a more lenient sentence as to not add insult to the injury of losing. And in large part, the crusade against him worked in the sense that he didn't win the election. Yeah, I think people will push less harshly for big conviction now.
Are analysts and observers who have been following the election placing a lot of weight on the trial as to how the election played out?
That's without a doubt. I mean, this blasphemy accusation and the mass demos against him were totally unexpected in their scope and popular sentiment. Of course, there were a bunch of other things bundled into that anti-Ahok sentiment, like his addictions program and his personality. So some of the things made him susceptible to such an attack, even though he's widely regarded as very clean, not corrupt, and effective governor. So once this thing kind of gained traction, it was impossible to underestimate. It took on a life of its own in WhatsApp groups and social media and really just convinced a lot of people not to vote for him. And, you know, that is evident in the votes.
That was reporter Kritika Varagar. She was speaking to VOA Steve Miller, and she's in Jakarta. Well, joining me here in the studio, welcoming back from the Boston Marathon, is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a lot of movement in Republican circles. Two big names are on their way out. The first is Jason Chaffetz. He's a congressman from Utah, and he's the chair of the House Oversight Committee. He's announced on Facebook that he will not run for re-election in 2018. Now, he had faced some controversy at constituent town halls around the health care bill. He had been shouted down by his constituents and faced a lot of current controversy around that bill on social media when he said that people shouldn't buy a new iPhone. They should use that money to pay for health care. A lot of mocking that went along with that. People saying my health care bill would be 40 iPhones worth. So some evidence that maybe he wasn't thinking about the plight of Americans and how much their health care costs there, as that's the allegation levied against him. But there's interesting speculation about why he's leaving. The committee conducts oversight over federal government, questions about whether he's resigning because of President Trump's activities. And then there's also the issue here in D.C. of a number of D.C. residents who have been raising money to try to oust Jason Chaffetz. As part of his duties as the House Oversight Committee chairman, he also has purview over Washington, D.C. and its laws.
Oh.
So a lot of people very unhappy that he was trying to get rid of certain things like same-sex marriage and legalize marijuana. So they were trying to oust him. So not clear why he's leaving, other than that he said he wants to go back to the private sector. Another big name in Republican circles who is apparently on the way out is Bill O'Reilly. He's the Fox News firebrand personality, loved by conservatives and vilified by liberals, reportedly being ousted by Fox after a series of million-dollar payments over sexual harassment allegations to women. So from the left, celebration that he's been apparently ousted. From the right, allegations of a witch hunt and hopes that he'll be back on screens sometime soon.
And also that just follows, we should say, the recent case involving Roger Ailes, who was ousted for, I guess, similar reasons.
Right. A lot of attention on Fox News and not the good kind. So Bill O'Reilly apparently on the way out. And then finally, today, 22 years ago, on April 19th, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. 168 people killed in the deadliest domestic terror attack in U.S. history. So remembering those victims today, 19 of whom were children that were killed in a daycare center there. So a lot of remembrances, even 22 years later, on social media.
Yeah, a lot of poignant, sad memories there. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia affirm cooperation in countering what they call Iran's mischief. Emirates Airline cuts flights to the U.S. as passenger demand wanes. The Supreme Court will hear whether church schools should have equal rights to state funds. And the British Parliament approves Prime Minister Theresa May's plan for early elections. Expanded coverage of these stories are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
You eat something salty and you get thirsty, right? A pair of new studies suggest that while after consuming that salty food, you may be thirsty initially, but within 24 hours, you become less thirsty but hungrier. Study authors explain that the drop in thirst is because after taking in the salt, our bodies begin to conserve and produce water. It's thought this new research may offer a fresh insight about obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. According to the senior author of the two studies, Dr. Jens Titze, MD, an associate professor of medicine and of molecular physiology and biophysics at Vanderbilt, it takes a lot of energy to conserve water as our bodies process salt. He says in order to produce this energy, the body either must consume its own fat reserves or muscle mass or take in more food, which can lead to overeating. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, what does an election in Georgia have to say about American politics? We'll find out. Turkey's High Electoral Board is evaluating opposition petitions for the annulment of Sunday's constitutional referendum giving President Recep Tayyip Erdogan sweeping new executive powers.
Bu seçim ne yazık ki meşruiyeti
Bulent Tezcan, deputy chairman of the Republican People's Party, has called the vote illegitimate, insisting it cannot be seen as official. European election monitors were joined by Turkey's Bar Association in questioning the counting of perhaps 2.5 million unstamped ballots that are not considered valid in tipping the election to the yes camp by a narrow 51% margin. Gareth Jenkins, a non-resident fellow of the Silk Road Studies Program at the Central Asia and Caucasus Institute, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, and he's speaking from Istanbul, that he doubts the challenge will have any success in the Turkish legal system.
I think the referendum is still going to be classed as legal. The question, of course, is rather whether it's going to be regarded as legitimate.
Do you sense a change in the public mood following this vote?
Yes, I think so, but only relatively minor. Erdogan's supporters are very committed to him. They believe everything and anything he says. But those who are opposed to him, certainly in the last few days, have been mobilized. We've seen quite a lot of street protests. And it's been interesting to see that some of the media, which is largely controlled by Erdogan, have begun to publish articles about incidences of fraud during the referendum.
The Turkish Prime Minister has called on the opposition to accept the results. Will they?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the most worrying things really about the referendum is that the government, particularly the Prime Minister and the President, have been saying everybody should accept the results without investigating the allegations of fraud. The allegations of fraud, of course, should be investigated first, and then if they're found to be groundless, then you can accept the result. But they're not even investigating the allegations.
Well, Gareth, there are reports that indicate that as many as 2.5 million ballots are considered unofficial and yet were counted. Is that the main issue?
It's one of the issues. Actually, we don't know the number because a lot of these unstamped ballot papers were retrospectively stamped to validate them. But there's a lot of other examples. For example, in some polling stations, you have more people who voted than were registered to vote. Under Turkish law, you can only vote in a polling station if you're registered to vote there. So it's impossible legally for more people to vote in a polling station than are registered. We have a lot of examples like that. Also examples of some polling stations where you had 100% turnout when a lot of people who are registered to vote there actually weren't present at the time.
European report from the OSCE is expected to come out soon on this referendum. If it is highly critical of the process, what will that do for Turkey's standing in the world?
I think it's going to be highly damaging. We've already seen the preliminary report from the OSCE, which was released on Monday, and that was very damning in itself. And I don't think there's any question that the full report is going to be even more so.
That is Gareth Jenkins of the Silk Road Studies Program at the Central Asia and Caucasus Institute. He spoke to VOA's Victor Beatty from Istanbul. Democrats claimed a partial victory early in the Trump presidency Tuesday as candidate John Ossoff advanced to a June election for the Georgia congressional seat vacated by Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. Activists and party donors still hurting from their 2016 election loss saw an opportunity in this Republican district that Trump won by only 1 point in 2016. VOA's Catherine Gibson traveled to Georgia in the final days before the election to learn more about the national stakes in the race.
Democrats declared victory in a high-stakes election watched as far as the White House.
We are changing the world.
Yeah!
And your voices are going to ring out across this state and across this country.
Change started in these suburban neighborhoods, helped along by an extraordinary $8.3 million fundraising haul and an army of volunteers looking for an opportunity to beat Trump even though he wasn't on the ballot.
We've got progressive people very worried and angry about Trump's policies. And this is the only race that's on the national stage right now.
Democratic activists like Cox see their work here in the Georgia 6 as a possible blueprint for 2018 midterm elections across the country, using an anti-Trump backlash to win back control of Congress. But Trump declared a runoff a win for Republicans, saying his support on Twitter as polls opened Tuesday and a last-minute recorded call appealing to voters.
Only you can stop the super liberal Democrats.
Made a difference as Ossoff failed to secure the majority needed for an outright win. The crowded Republican field is now narrowed to just one. Moderate Republican Karen Handel, heavily favored to win this district that hasn't sent a Democrat to Congress since the 1970s. And now that the choice is down to Handel, expect President Trump to rally Republican voters with a trip down to Georgia.
Donald Trump coming to town could be the biggest thing to happen in congressional elections in years.
The prize is just one seat out of 435, but each side has too much at stake to risk a loss. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Roswell, Georgia.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new documentary from Disney Nature Films, Born in China, follows the stories of three animal families, a panda and her cub, a snub-nosed golden monkey, and a rare snow leopard. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film marks a collaboration between the Chinese government and Disney to show the beauty and grandeur of China's wilderness.
The film follows three families, panda Yaya and her newborn cub Mei Mei, Dawa, a snow leopard taking care of her cubs in the Qinghai Plateau thousands of meters above sea level, and a playful, mischievous, snub-nosed golden monkey named Tao Tao who is dealing with the arrival of a baby sister. In typical Disney nature fashion, the photography is stunning, capturing vistas, forests, waterfalls, snow-covered hills, and other stunning visuals to tell the stories. Primatologist Dame Jane Goodall, who has studied chimpanzees for 55 years in Gombe Stream National Park, Tanzania, serves as a special ambassador for the film. She says that Born in China is not about Beijing or Shanghai or what people typically think of as China.
And also people will come to understand that China is protecting the wildlife, and China has got these large areas set aside to protect pandas and the snow leopard. So hopefully when people go away, they'll have a slightly different feeling about China, and they'll certainly go away with filled with awe, really, and wonder at the majesty of the scenery.
This is Dawa, and this incredible dreamscape is her home. At an altitude of 14,000 feet above sea level, the climate here is too cold for most mammals. But Dawa thrives here.
The cinematographers had to work for months to get the shots they needed. Locations included the Xialong Wetlands, the Sichuan Wulong National Nature Preserve, and the highest mountain plateau on Earth, the Qinghai Plateau. Jane Goodall says that patience played a big role in bringing the film to the screen.
They knew that they needed to have pandas in this movie because it's the iconic Chinese animal. And the snow leopard was a dream which a lot of wildlife photographers, you know, they're gosh, if only we could really get good film of snow leopards. And then the golden monkey is just this extraordinary character. And they're pretty ugly, really, but they're just, they're comical and they're fascinating. And so these three main characters, and the thing about Disney nature is that it's not just a quick in and out. These photographers wait a year in and year out, and so they're able to show the characters of these animals.
Outside of raising cubs, adult female pandas live almost completely solitary lives. So for Yaya, this is the most treasured time of her life.
Goodall adds that watching films like Born in China shows how closely humans and the animal kingdom are bound to each other and affect each other.
I think people can learn and must learn that there is no sharp line separating us from the rest of the animal kingdom, and that we should become much better stewards. We should respect animals. We should realize that, like us, they have personalities, they have minds, they have emotions. There's so much to learn.
The film is directed by Chinese director Lu Chuan and is narrated by John Krasinski. During the first week it is open, for every ticket bought, Disney Nature has pledged to donate 20 cents to the World Wildlife Fund, up to $100,000. The film opens in the United States on Friday, April 21st, Earth Day. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David. That sounds like a very interesting film. Well, that's our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies individuals who are important to the operation or specific agenda of a terrorist organization. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant threat of committing acts of terrorism. Occasionally, the designated individual is already in custody. This is the case of Anjem Chaudhry, who was named by the U.S. State Department as a specially designated global terrorist. Chaudhry was arrested in 2014 and sentenced to prison in 2016 for pledging allegiance to ISIS and for acting as a key figure in the group's recruitment drive. Along with Chaudhry, four other men were designated as specially designated global terrorists. They include Sami Bourras, a Swedish national of Tunisian descent and a member of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who is known to have planned suicide terror attacks; Shane Dominic Crawford of Trinidad and Tobago, who fights for ISIS in Syria and acts as an English language propagandist for the group; and Mark John Taylor of New Zealand, who has been fighting in Syria with ISIS since the fall of 2014 and appeared in a 2015 ISIS propaganda video to encourage terrorist attacks in Australia and New Zealand. The final member of this group is Al-Shafi Al-Sheikh, a member of a group of brutal ISIS operatives, dubbed the Beatles for their heavy British accents, who were put in charge of foreign-born hostages held by ISIS. Al-Sheikh and the other three members of the Beatles were markedly more brutal than other guards, using extreme methods to torture the prisoners. To date, they have executed at least 27 prisoners. A number of these executions were videotaped and posted on the internet by ISIS. On March 31st, these five men were marked by the U.S. State Department as specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. Their assets within U.S. reach are now frozen, and no U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with them. Designations expose and isolate organizations and individuals and result in denial of access to the U.S. financial system. Moreover, designations can assist or complement the law enforcement actions of other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.